Now we're going through the book of Job. Just going to be going through a few chapters. I'm not going to go through the whole book, but we are in chapter 5, which is still a continuation of his first friend talking. So I remember back there in chapter 4, and he said that he had heard a voice talk to him, that is, his friend did. And he says, now a word was secretly brought to me, verse 12 of fourth chapter. I'm going back for just a little bit here. And my ears received a whisper of it. Disquieting thoughts from the vision, he had a vision, of the night when deep sleep falls on men. Fear came upon me and trembling that made all my bones shake. Then a spirit passed before my eyes. The hair on my body stood up. It stood up. It stood still. But I could not discern its appearance. A form before my eyes. There was silence. Then the voice spoke. Remember, we talked about that last week. Now, the same friend now, he is telling his Job. And after this, quote, thing that was told to him in a vision, he turns around in chapter 5, verse 1, and he says, call out now, is there anyone who will answer you? Talking to Job. Which one of the holy ones or which one of the saints will you turn to for an answer? For wrath kills a foolish man. And envy slays a simple one. Now I remember his three friends. As we've gone this far, so far, we got the one right now. What is his approach to Job? You remember what we had last week? You don't remember. Remember, he's the one that told us that Job was a kind person. He was a gentle person. And when somebody was in need of help, he would be there, both in words and in actions. He would help those who are oppressed, down under, from others or from anything. And he's called the greatest of the kings of the East, meaning he owned more than anybody else did in the land of Edom. And he was wealthier. He had a larger army, a larger number of men than any of the other kings. Remember, there were 12 in the land of Edom. And Job is a great grandson of Esau himself. So we know that the book of Genesis talks about the 12 sons of Esau, and they were to be kings or leaders, or what we called noblemen, honor men of renown, or men who would be responsible and take it over and be in a leadership or some kind of form of kingship, or in your translations, duke. Means they were had something, they were in charge of things. And Job was the greatest of them all. Of all of the 12, he was the most powerful. He was the most wealthiest. He was the most compassionate. And the most upright of all those in the land of Edom. And that's what the subject matter is here. Now, we have already learned that his friend is finding fault with him. Because there's a belief system that's very strong, not only in the three friends of Job, but in society as a whole and as individuals as a whole. Because as we go on with this subject matter, we're going to find Job extremely bitter against God, hostile toward God, angry toward God, and accusing God of not hearing him. Those are pretty powerful statements, aren't they? Now, you may be trembling to think about doing that. I happen to know some people, I won't tell who they are, that do blame God for their turmoil. And they're bitter against God because God brought the bitterness or the turmoil or this horrible tragedy in their life. And they are, we might call in our world, because we do that in our world, we call them rebellion. Here, he's not accused of being rebellious. We have to find out what was Job's problem. All right, so let's continue on here. We're going to brushly go through, quickly I should say go through. I want to point out verse 3 and verse 4 in chapter 5. And he says, this is his friend saying, I have seen the foolish taking root. Suddenly, I curse his dwelling place. His sons are far from safety. They are cursed in the gates, and there's no deliverance. Guess what? Who he's talking about? Job. What happened to his sons? They all were killed by a whirlwind. And he says, I have, look at number 3 now, verse 3 now, I have seen foolish taking root. And I find myself cursing his dwelling place. So now his friend is not friendly anymore. He's blaming Job for what has been taking place. Before we go a little farther, I want to talk about what's called paradigms. Paradigm is your center of how you think, how you view life, how you view and what you do in your world. As we go through these three men, you'll find each one of them have a different paradigm. They have a different viewpoint against Job. And you say, okay, okay. As we go through these three, look within yourself. Do you kind of relate to any one of these three? Because one of them gets really hostile, which typically someone who is, quote, a Christian, and they are pretty sure they know the Word of God, when they find another Christian not doing what God wants them to do, you'll find them judging the person. And it's these three men, three different viewpoints. And the book of Job is there for us to understand something. Not just to understand the sin or the bad stuff or the unknown sin of Job, because this book is more telling us how God views us as individuals looking at somebody else and saying, oh, you have transgressed God. God never, ever punishes a righteous man. Job comes back and says, yes, he does. God never destroys the righteous man's way and his belongings. They're never, never. God always protects it. Job says, no, God does do destruction. God will destroy, we'll find out later, both the fool and the wise. Destroy them both? We'll have to find out more in detail. Because in the end of the book, there's something that God said to his three friends. What Job has said about me is correct. What you have said about me is not correct. Those are pretty strong words, don't you think? And so we have to ask God, what is this point? What are we doing? Now, verse 8, he boasts, he says, but as for me, a good Christian, I would seek Elohe. I would seek God, and Elohe would do what? Commit my cause. He would hear me, Job, but he won't hear you because why? You're not seeking Elohe. You're not seeking God. You got the first part of this book? What was he known for? The fearing of God. More than these men. And so these are things that we, as individuals, we go through the book of Job, to watch and be careful how we view somebody and their trials, quote, their sins, quote, their desperation of life. And you have no idea what God is doing at all. And that's the purpose of Job, is that we should look and say to ourselves, all right, when I see somebody, quote, disagreeing with God, why should I look at Job? It would appear, when we go through what Job's answer is, that he is disagreeing with God. Really? We'll find out, won't we? We go on this chapter. I'm not going to stay too very long on this one. He says, he's talking about verse 9, who does great things, meaning Elohe, and unsearchable, the marvelous things without number, and he gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. Verse 15, but he saves the needy from the sword. Oh. Did God save Job, or did God kill everything Job had? Didn't God? Why would God not save? That means, Job, you didn't need anything. God only saves the needy, but not you. Because you got everything. Right? It's from the mouth. The mouth and the mighty and from their hand. That's what God does. Takes away the power, the might, the strength from others who go against the needy with a sword. Now you remember, his men were killed with a sword. His army was killed with a sword. You remember that? And he says now, verse 16, so the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth. Really? Okay. Verse 20, in famine, he shall redeem you from death, if, of course, you respond to him. And in war, from the power of the sword, you shall be hidden from the surge of the tongue, and you shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes. Now, Job, we've already read earlier, he was terrified. The thing he said that I feared the most has happened to me. And it happened. Now, is it because he had no peace in his tent? He had nothing that was misaligned? Nothing was amiss? We have that. Now what did Job say? What was Job's answer? Chapter 6. The first man that spoke was his, quote, best friend. The next one is his next friend, and the next one's friendly, but not his great friend. You kind of tell by his words that he snapped back at them. And as the book continues goes on, we won't go through all the arguments back and forth, because that's not what I'm here for. And he said now to his first friend, "Oh, that my grief were fully weighted, and my calamity lie within on the scales, you friend of mine." Verse 4. "For the arrows of Almighty within me," the arrows that God shot at Job, they're in him. He got hit. He got hit hard. When God shoots an arrow, he doesn't miss. He's always on target. And he aimed right where he wants to aim. And it does its damage. He goes on. "My spirit drinks in their poison." So here, the darts, his arrows, are also poisonous. Almighty God's arrows are poisonous. That's what Job was saying, right? We're playing words, understand. "The terrors of Elohe are arrayed against me." Now, that's what he's telling his friend, who told him, "By the way, if you were like me, you would seek Elohe. You would seek God. And you would have a better life. But since you don't seek God, you got all the curses." Now, in our human way of thinking, when we see somebody in trial, whether they are, quote, of the world or, quote, not of the world, I don't care which way you want to look at it, and we say, "Oh, this one, because God is against him, he gets the curse of God." Well, maybe not. And if he does get the curse of God, what business is it of ours to judge them, saying, "God's cursed you"? We don't have that right. We don't have the right to judge somebody, in this particular case, Job. Now we say, "Well, but my friend over here is not Job. I could accuse that person of this sin, this corruption, that bad thing, and this bad thing, and horrible things. I could do that because my righteousness can see his or her unrighteousness. Therefore, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to tell him." That's what these three friends do. Is this not a correction? Yes, it's a correction of how we should be looking at each, every one of us, and even, what did the Messiah say? Your enemy. Your enemy. Be careful. Don't judge your enemy according to your righteousness or what you think the righteousness of God is against your enemy. You know, you understand what I'm saying? Not that hard to figure out. Yes. I'm sorry, what? I keep your enemies close. Okay. But don't judge them.
Right.
Let God do what he's going to do. Sometimes we don't think God's involved with anybody else except us. Or let's put more in. No, he's not involved with anybody else except those who keep the Sabbath. Or those who keep the Sabbath and the holy days. Or those who keep the Sabbath and the correct days of the holy days. Right? We're right. Everybody else is wrong. Not according to God. You understand what I'm saying? This book teaches us, watch your tongue. More than that, pay attention to your mind. My wife, we went to shopping for something. I can't remember what it was out of hand, but anyway. So I supposed to write down the notes. What we're going to be doing. And then, of course, you know, she took it. That's my wife. And then she says, "You know what? My hand doesn't go as fast as my brain." You know what I told her? I says, "My hand goes as fast as my brain. It can't go past." I said to her, "My brain is the ultimate power." It controls what the hand does. The hand doesn't control the brain. It can't go faster. It can't go slower because the brain is the power. In a lot of sense, when we start thinking how somebody else should live, what are we doing? You're allowing your brain to make a final decision about somebody. And then comes forth the actions against them. Do you understand? Your brain's the most powerful thing God gave you, and it will respond, and your actions will follow its command. You understand what I'm saying? So we have to look at, here are these three friends. Their brain was thinking of something else. Yes.
Do you think that the enemy jumps on that too? Who? Like the enemy, Hasatan. I mean, wouldn't he want to feed into you making a judgment of someone?
Well, I'll tell you, I can understand that to a degree. But basically, God has never turned to anybody in the Bible, any place, anywhere, that says, the reason why you think this way is because the devil's increased the thinking. He always judges the person for what they do, what they think. He never judges that the devil made him do it.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, that once you start a pattern of thought, negative thought towards someone, as in judging, it increases.
Oh, of course, yes. And we need to take power over that, okay? The book of Job tells you how to do it. You don't think it does? Take a look. As we go on, let's go quickly here. Where was I at? Okay. Verse 8. Oh, that I might have my request, that Elohe would grant me the thing that I long for. What does it long for? That it would please Elohe to crush me. That he would loose his hand from off and cut me off. Well, that's pretty powerful, isn't it? Looked like he got a rotten sticking attitude, right? So let's judge him. Right? Let's go ahead and judge him now. Right? Does God do that? Does God really do that? And God said, what Job said about me is correct. Wow. You mean God will crush a righteous man? Yes. Do righteous people die? Yes. Do righteous people lose many things? Yes. Do righteous people receive wrong? Yes. And why? What for reason? Why would God do that?
Because God is potter and we are clay.
Well, that's not according completely what I'm trying to get across. There's something he's doing. One of these days I've got to talk about that. Yes.
To test the heart?
You're getting close. You're getting close. Oh, if there were a heart in you, then I would. See, that's the bottom line. That's the heart. How do you have a heart for God? Do you have a heart for God? Well, you say, well, of course I do. Just look at me. Look at my life. Look what's happened to me. I must have a heart and love for God. A heart for God. However, yes.
Well, the book of Psalms talks about what God looks like and what his heart is. And he lets it rain on the just and the unjust. And he straightens bent things. And he gives sight to the blind. And he feeds all of the animals every day. He provides shelter for them every night. He hears prayers of people who are ignorant of his ways. He protects people. His ways are continuously magnanimous. So if God looks at we humans who are sometimes ignorant and sometimes foolish, with patience and even kindness, will he look as patiently and kindly upon me if I'm mad at everybody because they did it wrong according to the Gospel of Ellie? I don't
think
according
to the Gospel of Ellie, she read the Gospel.
I think that makes God mad. So to me, I am very wise if I keep my yardstick in my back pocket and keep it buttoned, then I don't have to worry about him pulling out that yardstick and using it against me because I used it improperly against someone else. That's what? His territory.
Good. What we have here in the book of Job seems very strange to us because we look upon God as kind, merciful, wonderful, creator, right? But at the end of the book, that's what it presents. But something had to happen to Job in his life in order for Job to get that knowledge about God. Now, God said he's a righteous man. He had integrity. He had endurance. He had fortitude. And he had fear of God. But there's one thing he missed. And then the book tells you. Let's continue on real quick. Here, verse 11. What strength do I have that I should have hope? And what is the end? That I should prolong my life. Now, that's a very powerful statement, isn't it? Now, if you heard a young lady say that, let's say a teenage girl say, why should I prolong my life? The first thing grabbed in our mind is what? Suicide. Do you realize that Job was at that point? That's how miserable he was. With suicide. Did you ever notice that in Scripture? Did you ever notice that he went to that point? He was so sorrowful for himself, self-centered in a sense, that he says, I can't end my life. I can't take it anymore. Because I don't have the strength of stones and I don't have the strength of bronze. Now, let's go down to verse... I'm going to break into a bit of a thought. Verse 24. He's still talking to his friend here, who accused him of things Job said he's not guilty of. Which is true. He wasn't guilty of those things. His friend said he was guilty of something else. And he says, teach me, I'll keep my tongue quiet. I'll hold my tongue. I won't say anything back. Really? Job really had a lot to say back. Anyway, cause me to understand where I have erred. Or I blew it. Tell me where I went wrong. Tell me where my thinking and my pattern and everything in my life was. What did I do to deserve the loss of not only my sons and my daughters, but the loss of all the men that worked for me, and loss of all the cattle, loss of all the donkeys, loss of all the camels, and loss of all the goats and sheep. Tell me where I made a mistake. how forceful are right words. That's not meaning right in the sense of right and wrong. How forceful are your words in a sense you think is right? They're powerful. You know, what's that old saying? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but whatever you say won't bother me one bit. We lie to ourselves an awful lot, don't we? Job said, yeah, what you are saying to me, they are forceful. But what are you arguing about? You have no point. You indeed rebuke words, or do you rebuke works and the speeches of a what kind of a person? Desperate one as wind. So he says, now what you're saying to me, friend, is the things I am saying and how I feel, what makes me angry, what makes me upset, what makes me feel the sorrow and the pain, the agony. I wish the day never existed that I was born. I wish I was born or aborted, born, stillborn, born dead. And you're saying what? That what you're saying is like out there meaning nothing. Wind means it kind of blows away. And it says, you say that to someone who is what? Desperate. What's he desperate for? Well, would you like to live his life at this point in time? You'd be in definition. You would have, wow, I don't know if I can go any farther in life. That's what he thought too, right? Let's go to the seventh chapter. This seventh chapter, now Job is addressing God. Now, I'm not saying that you may never have said these things, but when somebody who God has done something to, that person feels the agony. You don't. I've often taught people when they're in a state of a trial, and I always tell them, well, let's say as a family got a trial. I said, who's the one that's more upset? And they'll say, well, that one over there, but troubled me. No, that one over there, that's the trial for. The one that's upset is the one the trial's for. And the book of Job says, it is God doing it. Watch what he is going to do to Job. To bring Job to where he, God, wants him to be. Trials that are sometimes very hard, very difficult, are not necessarily aimed at a bunch of sins, transgressions, iniquities, and all that kind of stuff. It's aimed at something else. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, you know what it says? Let make man in our image. Now, what is that image? Is that image like the one here, like Job? And God going against him? Is that the image God is really trying to do? At the end of the book, God changes Job to be like him. Not like a man, not like a woman, but like him. That's the goal of the whole book of Job. And sometimes we say, do I have to go through that? Well, not as bad as Job, perhaps, but a lesson in Job that we can understand. An attitude that we say, boy, he had one sneaking attitude. Is it not, verse 1 of chapter 7, is it not a time for hard service for man on earth? His days also like the days of a hired man, like the servant who earnestly desires the shade, and like the hired man who eagerly looks for his wages. So I have been allotted months of futility and wearisome nights, and have been appointed to me. And I lie down and I say, oh, when shall I rise up? When is the end of nights for me? For I had my full of tossing and turning. Does that sound familiar? Have you ever been so upset at night you can't sleep? And you're tossing and turning because something is not right, something's amiss, something's wrong. Hey, welcome to the club of Job. Okay? Now, verse 7. Oh, remember me, that my life is a breath. My eyes will never again see pleasure. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. Your eyes are upon me. I shall no longer be. He goes down here. Let's go down to verse 12. He says, I see a sea. In other words, he's saying, I see a sea serpent that you sent to guard over me. Did that's exactly what God did? Who now is guarding over Job? You don't remember? Satan. The adversary. Now the goal of the adversary isn't to keep him alive. Goal of the adversary is to kill him. The adversary does not lead people into hard trials, hard difficulties. The goal of the adversary is to kill him. And in any which way, shape, or form, I'll kill him. Wasn't that his goal at the very beginning? If you, well, you won't die. And guess what? They didn't. Because you can't kill the soul. You can kill the body, but not the soul. And this is the Messiah says, fear the one that can kill soul. Fear that one. Now, in our world, trying to learn what that means, back in those, they knew exactly what it referred to. When Job said, my spirit, it's like saying, my soul, you have anguished. When you think of the word hope, what is it that rings to your mind? Nothing? Life at the end of the tunnel. That's life. Have it to live life forever. That's the final hope. When God says, I have created man in vain or worthlessness about him, I also created a man with hope that he will live forever. And a lot of us just say, like Job, I need to kill myself. But he can never get away from that. Yes, he can kill his flesh, but he can't kill the soul. He knows God's going to handle him through and by his soul. Verse 7. Oh, remember me that I am just a breath. Remember that? That's exactly what he created. Remember Adam? He breathed something into his nostrils. Breath. Okay, remember God, I'm just, and you put the serpent over me to rule my life. Remember, he had both lost everything and he was in bad health. bad health. His health was so bad that he couldn't stand that unhealthy place. So he had to sit on a bunch of ashes. Very significant, he sat on a bunch of ashes. Under you, the enemy will be as ashes. Job sat on that thing, not just because he was sore, because he was the enemy of God. That's how he felt. Now, remember the book of Romans says, while you were at war with God, you're the enemy against God. What did he do? He sent his son to save your life. Oh. Pretty powerful statement, right? Verse 14, you have scared me with dreams. You have terrified me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling death rather than my body. My soul wants to die. I need my soul to no longer be, rather than just my body dying. That's a pretty powerful statement, right? Remember I talked to you about the difference between the two? Well, you said, boy, he had a really stinking attitude, didn't he? Verse 70, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning, test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow in my own saliva? He's talking to God. Have I sinned? What have I done? O watcher of men, why hath you set me as your target? You ever felt that way? Ever met somebody maybe that you think the devil is targeting you? Well, here, the Eternal used the devil to rule over the life of Job. Who's responsible for that? God. Pretty powerful stuff, right? So what am I a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgressions? Right? Have you ever asked God that? Why haven't you forgiven me? Oh, you who's full of mercy, compassion, understanding, and knowing I'm breath only. Do you think he was foolishly and he didn't ask for it? He says, what have I done? How can you say to God, forgive me of my sin, when you don't even know what it is? No, that's a question mark at verse 20. Have I sinned? It's actually a question. The next one says, what have I done to you? Question. Oh, watcher of men, why have you set me as your target? Question. So that I may have a burden upon myself? Question. Those are all questions. He's challenging God with a statement. That's just not a statement. That, however you translate that, when you really look at that whole thing. The Job, by the way, is the oldest written book. And it's written very old, ancient Hebrew. And there's a lot of different translations. And everyone who translates that, translates it based upon their paradigm. Even if it's a group, it's their group. They come and this is what they view Job as. I have read Jewish ones, that's over here. Doesn't even look like that one. Doesn't even look like a different paradigm, different view. Over here, wow, not even, all three different ways of looking at Job. We have to ask, what does it say in Hebrew? Yes.
Is this not an indication of arrogance and pride in Job?
You're getting close, but that's not the complete one. There's something, yes, to a degree. I'll not disagree with you on that one. But there's an even greater thing on that God wants. Okay? We'll see the air when we get there. I'm just kind of wrapping this thing up as quickly as I can. I might get into the 8th chapter in just a minute. And he said, why won't you pardon me? Why don't you take away my iniquity? Have you ever asked God in your world, God, Father, help take away my inclination to do this rotten thing? So you're no different than Job, are you? What was God's answer? No. For how will I lie down in the dust, going back into the grave, and you will seek me diligently, but I am no longer there. Where am I going to go? I'm going to lie down in that dirt where I came from. And you won't see me anymore. I'm gone. In the flesh. That's pretty hard stuff so far, isn't it? Now, that's Job's words. Yes?
I don't see arrogance here. I see pain and getting...
We're getting farther on down the line, what Job said.
Getting the picture of just who a human being
is. He's mad at God. He's mad at God at this point in time.
Well, the losses are hard.
That's what God wanted to accomplish. That's what God wanted to bring out about Job so we can understand what God wants to bring out of us. That we may be able to do something about what he wants to bring out of us. God did not take away our iniquity. We must get it out of ourselves. What did he say to Cain? It's at your door. It's in your house. Get it out. He didn't say, by the way, Cain, I'll get rid of this sin for you. No, he says, close the door. Kick it out and close the door. God created us to fight ourselves. That's very evident in the very, very beginning of Genesis. Yes.
In order to not be arrogant in a time like this, you have to really know that God is way beyond us. And we need to get down and know. We know nothing. What? How can we know anything? Well, we know nothing.
That's funny, because the argument comes up later on with the book of Job.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, really? I mean, do we really believe in God? If we really believe in God, we know he knows everything, and we're just like, what are we but sand on the beach? I mean, that's the truth.
Now, in chapter 8, his second friend talks. All right? Basically, his name really means son of the contention. That's all his name means. And that's not really an important thing to know. But he is related to Abraham in that he is related that Keturah was his grandmother. Remember who Keturah was? That was a second wife of Abraham. Now he says, how long will you speak thus? And the words of your mouth, a strong wind. Really, worthlessness. Why you're saying Job as it's worthless. Really. Does Elohim submit judgment? Subvert judgment, rather? Or does El Shaddai pervert justice? Interesting. Let's come on. Verse 4. If your sons, now this is the first accusation, that the reason why his sons were killed is because of his sons, their sons' sin and transgression. That's not what God said. Now, we can interpret it. This guy accused. If your sons have sinned against him, God, he has cast them away for their transgression. That's why they died. They were sinners. Really? See, it's easy for us, since we have wonderful, beautiful wisdom and hindsight, that God never kills anybody unless they are sinners. God never damages or harms a righteous man, ever. Just the unrighteous one. That makes sense, right? Because human beings say, oh, God is love and merciful and compassionate and all that kind of stuff. Here we see him say, the typical statement that I have heard, there's only two writers ever, you know, all the history that I've ever read that also blame sins upon the sons. Yes.
Isn't it somewhere written, I think even in the New Testament, sometimes God destroys the body to save the soul?
Kills the body?
To save the soul.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole object. That's the whole object. That's not new. That's very plain to understand. That's how God works. Would you have earnestly seek, if you, Job, would have earnestly seek Elohim and made your supplication to the Almighty, if you had a pure heart and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper you right fully dwelling place. Isn't that a normal, typical accusation? It really is. When we see somebody in real serious trouble, it's because why? Your heart is not pure. Your heart is not upright. Yes.
The irony is that he's actually absolutely right. He says here, if you're pure and upright, surely God will rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. Now, we know a few chapters from now that's exactly what happens.
Right. Later on, we'll find out what happened. So we're reading here. We're finding out a little bit of things about what's going on. Verse 8. For iniquity, please. No, wait, verse 4, 7. Though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly if, of course, you had a pure heart and upright one. For inquire, please, of the former times, and consider the things discovered by their fathers. It worked for, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Job not working for you because why? Because your heart is not pure and you're not upright, even though God said he was upright. What is what is a pure heart compared to an impure heart? Do you know the difference between a pure heart and an impure heart? Pure means clean. if your heart was clean rather than unclean? Yes.
How can a young man keep his way pure? By living according to your word.
Actually, it's one more step farther than that. We'll get to the end of the book. Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The picture I'm seeing so far with Job, up to this point, he was upright. He gave to the poor. He did all these things, all these works. But the heart, yet, there was still the connection between the heart issue versus just doing good things.
We will find, on my personal opinion, can I have one? I think his heart was pure. I think his heart was upright. I think his heart was with God. There's something that was missing that made him have to change his paradigm. Looking through the eyes of God, not through the eyes of his three friends, or even Job himself. Do you often think about that, about yourself? Yes, Ellie.
Because in the first chapter, it says, even through all this, he did not sin. This guy was pure-hearted and upright and good. And anybody would want him for a friend or a neighbor or...
Well, not according to Bildad.
Yeah, but Job had a noose around his neck when Bildad was yelling at him, too.
I'm just saying it. It's so easy to kind of, okay, they're making sense. Of course they're making sense. In human thinking. God is not out there to destroy life. He's out there to save life. And we think he's out there to save flesh and blood. He didn't create Adam and Eve and the flesh to save their fleshly life. He created Adam and Eve to be like him. Is God made of flesh? Therefore, the flesh has to learn something. The funniest thing about this world that God created, everything you ever do is earthy. Every food you eat is earthy. Every book you read is earthy. Have you ever thought about that? So, you and I are earthy people. Now God says, no, I'm up there, you're down there on the earth. You don't think like I think, I'm up there. Now, that's a funny thing about that. God says, I want you to fly like an eagle. I rethought about that some years ago. Flying like an eagle. Okay. What's an eagle? How's the eagle? What does the eagle fly like? Well, flies high, look down, he sees his prey, and phew, down there he got it, right? Oh. So I gotta fly like an eagle to get my prey, to get what I want to eat? Is that what God had in mind? What is so unique about the eagle's eyes? They see everything. They're over the olam. If you understand that really Hebrew phrase. They're over the horizon. They see above the horizon. No mountains blocking the view. No clouds blocking. Nothing blocking the view. They see a tremendous amount of things. So when God says, come up and fly like an eagle, see what I see. Every one of us, I think, are wanting to talk to God face to face. We really do. Do you think it's possible? It did with Moses. You remember? I speak to Moses face to face. Now, in our mind, that means I get to really look at your mugshot, right? No. I get to talk with you. You get to talk with me. Every one of us want to face God face to face. And an earnest prayer, or even a prayer that you're requesting of God, or even just talking to God, that's a face-to-face relationship with God. If you hear also what he has to say, if you don't hear what he has to say, it's not going to come. All right. That's the end of this guy's story. I don't need to go any farther than him, right? Okay, yes. We're going to go next week, chapter 9. But now, chapter 9, he answers his second friend. So we realize that the first friend had a different viewpoint, didn't he, of Job. The second one has, oh, this viewpoint of Job. And they both base it upon how they see God's, they think they see through God's eyes. That's because of your actions, because God would not do that to you if you weren't that way. And this guy comes farther. He's even, his words are a little bit to the point, blunt. He didn't talk very long, but bam, really heavy. Well, Job's going to have an answer for him too. Now, it's normal for human beings, of course, except me, that never happened to me, that when you were attacked, you defend yourself. Oh, I'd never do that, right? I'm a good guy. I never defend myself when someone's attacking me, right? Of course, you don't either, do you? Well, we should be in that state, though. That no matter what someone says toward us, we must see their paradigm. Their paradigm views life differently than we may view life differently on an individual basis. Do you understand what I'm saying? We're looking right now at three men. Right? Job's best friend, Job's somewhat friend, and Job himself. As we proceed, we're seeing more and more what Job's viewpoint of God is. And he contradicts the viewpoint of his first friend, and he contradicts the viewpoint of his second friend. We'll get into the third one. You'll see the same pattern. He's got another paradigm that he looks at Job through. By the way, these three men are not wicked, perverse, corrupt, liars, cheaters, robbers, thieves. They're friends. They're friends. They're not out to destroy Job. They're doing their very best to help Job see the light. They wouldn't be there if they didn't have that approach. But what kind of light were they trying to show? That's what the point is. They themselves believed they had the light to show Job why you God does this to you, why God did this to you. Because we see why. Don't you understand what took place? Job, it's wide open for everybody else to see. Of course, except for the fourth man. He didn't quite see it that way. But we won't go there. Not today. So, I know that not this. It may be difficult to go through the book of Job. This is only the second week, by the way. Next week, I hope to be able to go through up to chapter, I think it's 12. Which it goes, it's going to go faster now because you're getting the overall thought of what the book is all about. And so we won't go back over the other arguments which these three friends did again and again and again and again because it's a repetition of the same pattern. But I would advise you to take a look and look closely on your own. When I write things like the book of Job, I don't write it when I copy it, I don't write it in sentence form. Because it wasn't written in the very beginning with perfect Hebrew grammar. It was imperfect Hebrew grammar. That statement. I mean, it doesn't have a verb, doesn't have a predicate, doesn't have a noun, doesn't have... It's just a statement. It starts with and. It's improper. Really? God is not messing around with making sure that you understand that he has perfect Hebrew grammar. He just tells you, bam, 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 bam. And we turn to God and say, what do you mean by that? He says the same three words. Oh, what do you mean? Same three words. He's not going to go explain any farther? Doesn't have to. Three is enough.